I'm Jeff Williams from Brooklyn, New York.
I'm Natalie from Boston, Massachusetts.
I'm Matt from Cambridge.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production.
Supported by listeners like you and me.
If you'd like to support the show like I did, visit MaximumFun.org and click on donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the show is the singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright III. Since the early 1970s, he's been making sharp, funny albums of, I guess, what you might call folk music. He's also worked extensively as an actor, a career that started with a three-episode arc on MASH and has continued into several of the films of Judd Apatow, as well as the Judd Apatow sitcom Undeclared, and of course his important role in the smash hit guinea pig themed film G-Force. His brand new album is a tribute to country music legend Charlie Poole. It's called High, Wide, and Handsome. Here's a song from it called Moving Day.
Landlord said this morning to me, give me a key, this flat ain't free. I can't get no rent out of you. Pack up your rags and skidoo. I said, wait until my bill comes home. He's my honey from the honeycomb. He'll have money cause he told me so this morning. Because it's moving day, moving day. Rip the carpet up off of the floor. Take your oil stove and out the door. It's moving day. Pack your folding bed and get away. If you spend every cent, you can live out in a tent. Because it's moving day.
Loudon Wainwright, welcome to The Sound of Young America. It's great to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to talk to you about Charlie Poole in a minute, but first I want to ask you about a couple of things that, as I was reading about your life, struck me as unusual. One was, I was reading about your family, and not just your children, several of whom are accomplished musicians, but your parents. Your father was a columnist for for Life magazine. Your mother, at least according to a bio that I read, was a yoga instructor.
That's right, she was.
Now, I don't mean to blow your cover, but you're in your early 60s, so you know you were a teenager in the, you know, you're a kid in the 50s and 60s, not the 70s and 80s or 80s and 90s or other times when someone might imagine that someone's mom would be a yoga instructor.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you to have a mom who was a yoga instructor in, say, 1962?
Well, in 1962, she wasn't a yoga instructor. She was a housewife. But in about 1968, I went to San Francisco to participate in the, well, it was 67, to participate in the Summer of Love. And after experimenting with pharmaceutical substances, I found myself swerving toward the east and studied yoga and was actually in a yoga ashram in Virginia City, Nevada. And then a few years later, I turned my mom onto yoga, and that would have been in the 70s, and she embraced it and studied it really a great deal and became a teacher herself. So I turned my mom on to yoga.
Your father was a columnist, as I mentioned, and
he would not have become a yogi.
That's a really hard job.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a job where you have to do like a kind of writing that's super painful, because you have to write a column. How did you perceive his work when you were a kid?
Well, he was a very, you know, in his world, he was quite successful. I mean, I had a famous father in the 60s when he was writing He had his column was called A View from Here, and he could write about anything he wanted to. And he wrote political things and personal things, and you know, he had free rein. But as you say, a deadline, writing to a deadline, was tough. And I observed him, you know, being stressed out a lot, and you know, anxious about how it was going, and you know. I watched him be tortured as a writer, I suppose. Also, he, you know, most journalists want to be novelists, or many do anyway, I imagine. And he was no different. He wanted to write books too, but he was writing for the magazine. So he was probably beating himself up about that too.
What did you think about what he did?
Well, at the time, you know, in his heyday, I was a teenager and a young man, and, you know, we had that Oedipal kind of competitive thing. So I didn't actually read a lot of his columns. You know, I was a smart ass, and you know how young people are. And but now, when I look back, you know, I have all of his columns, and I send them around to people. He was really a great writer. I mean, particularly when he wrote about his personal life and feelings and things having to do with family and you know, the specifics of and the generalities of all that. I mean, I've grown, you know, I'm 63 now. It's taken me a long time, but I'm a huge fan of my father's work. I think he really did a lot of great work.
It's interesting that you say that one of the things that you liked most in his writing was him writing about his personal life. You've written a lot about your personal and family life in your songs. Was there a relationship between those two? Were you always a fan of the idea of your father writing about himself and his family, or did your perspective on that autobiographical idea change as you went from, you know, being a teenager to being an adult?
Well, you know, I've my stuff is, as you say, it's very autobiographical, a lot of it. And the first line of the first song on my first record was "In Delaware When I Was Younger." That was the line. You know, I immediately started to write about my life. And maybe it was because I had read his personal columns and really liked them, or maybe I just inherited that genetic trait of you know, that propensity to divulge or to, you know, to talk about yourself or sing about yourself, maybe a combination of the two things.
Before we got on the line, I was listening to a song that you wrote called A Father and a Son that's about your relationship with your family, both backwards and forwards. When you write these kinds of songs about yourself and your family, do you ever wonder whether you've made the right decision to write something that's so personal and also, you know, so plain in a way that many songwriters who are writing about themselves aren't doing?
I don't really think about it that much. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it depends on how good the song turns out. And you know, A Father and a Son explores that father-son dynamic, and it does a good job of it, I think. I mean, I write a song, and then I take it out and I sing it in a club or for people, and I can usually tell if it works or not. And I don't really worry too much about what it's actually doing, or if it has an effect on people, then it's a success as far as I'm concerned.
When you say, that's interesting to me that when you say if it has an effect on people, one of the things that's very distinctive about many of your songs is that they're funny, which isn't a quality that a lot of singer-songwriters are shooting for. And many of your songs have other kinds of effects on people. Do you see any kind of hierarchy of value of the effects that you have on people?
Not at all. I mean, I as you say, I mean, my most successful song to date, anyway, is it was a novelty song called "Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road" that you know was on the radio in the early 70s. I mean, I love being silly and making an audience laugh, and yet at the same time, or you know, on the other hand, I also like getting in there and tackling more serious or you know touching. You know, I like to think of myself as a switch hitter. You know, I can hit both ways. I can be serious and depressing, and then I can be kind of silly and goofy. And I mean, some of my favorite songwriters are people like Tom Lehrer and you know, the records that Stan Freberg did. I mean, this is old stuff. I don't know if your listeners know about this stuff, but they should. I was big fans of them when I was a kid growing up, and Alan Sherman is another name which people should Google.
Hello, mother. Hello, father.
Right. I love that stuff. I love that stuff.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Loudon Wainwright III, whose new album, High, Wide, and Handsome, is a tribute to the music of Charlie Poole. You got your guitar with you there. Why don't you play for us one of his greatest successes, a song called "The Deal," and before you do, tell us a little bit about the song and why you chose it for this collection.
Well, this "The Deal," "Don't Let the Deal Go Down," was Charlie Poole's big hit. I mean, it sold. He recorded it in 1926. He came up to New York. Columbia Records used to have a studio in a building on Broadway. Here in New York, and he cut four sides, and one of them was "The Deal," and it sold 102,000 copies, which was a huge hit, and they were paid. His band was three guys, him and two other guys, a fiddle player, and a guitar player. They were paid the grand total of $75. But between the three of them, and that's all the money he ever saw from that. But you know, the record kind of put him on the map because it got radio play and people loved it. And so I suppose, you know, it's that age-old excuse that the record companies give you. You know, we gave you your career. Anyway, this is "The Deal." Wide world, down to Memphis, Tennessee, any old place I hang my hat that looks like home to me. I left my little girl crying, standing in the door, throwed her arms around my neck, saying, "Honey, don't you go, don't let your deal go down, don't let your deal go down, don't let your deal go down, till your last gold dollar is gone." Who's gonna shoe your pretty little feet? Who's gonna glove your hand? Who's gonna kiss your sweet little lips? Who's gonna be your man? Papa can shoe my pretty little feet. Mama can glove my hand. No one will kiss my sweet little lips till you come home again. Don't let your deal go down, don't let your deal go down, don't let your deal go down, yeah, till your last gold dollar is gone. Ah,
to Memphis, Tennessee. And the old place I hang my hat, that looked like home to me.
We'll be back with more from Loudoun Wainwright III on The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
Max FunCon is MaximumFun.org's annual convocation of things that are awesome. You can join me and dozens of great teachers and performers for a weekend in a retired hunting lodge in the woods this May here in Southern California. We'll have comedy from Mark Maron, Al Madrigal, Maria Bamford, Jimmy Pardo, Casper Hauser, Elephant Larry, and more, plus talks from author and comic John Hodgman, rocker Andrew W.K., and Radiolab's Jad Abumrad, among others, and classes on everything from crafting to improv to the art of the cocktail. For more information on Max FunCon, visit maxfuncon.com. That's maxfuncon.com. But remember that slots fill up fast. Welcome back to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Loudoun Wainwright III, whose new album, High, Wide, and Handsome, is a tribute to the music of Charlie Poole. Charlie Poole was an artist who... you know, like a lot of music performers before, you know, recording technology was ubiquitous, recorded all kinds of different songs, including novelty songs and kind of songs that were, you know, old fashioned even by the time he was performing them in the 20s or whatever. What was the appeal of Charlie Poole to you when you first heard him?
Well, I just loved the his singing and his playing and the whole energy and feeling of his records. People should go out if they want to actually hear Charlie Poole himself. There's a wonderful box set called "You Ain't Talking to Me," which has he recorded about 100 sides, they called them, songs. And they were around 78 vinyl records. And that box set has pretty much all of them. He just had this great sound, you know. He didn't write his songs, but as you say, they were the popular songs of his day, novelty songs and train songs and mother songs and parlor ballads and even some gospel material. I mean, he had a wide range and... He just was an amazing artist. I probably heard him for the first time in the early 70s, and he's not very well known. A lot of people know about Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family. He was around when they were, but somehow he got missed, I think, or certainly not his due. It's shameful. He's not even in the Country Music Hall of Fame, which is pretty strange because he was really great.
He drank himself to death at a very... inopportune time in the course of popular music history for someone who might want to get recognized later on. He died in 1931, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, he in that great country tradition, he drank himself to death. He went on a 13-week bender. He had just actually things had been not going well at all. I mean, he'd had some big success in the mid-20s, but by 1930, he was back working in a mill down in north-central North Carolina, which is where he was from, a town called Spray. He was back at the mill, you know, and then he had gotten a call from Hollywood, and they were going to get him out to put him on a train out to California, and he was going to be in a movie. And so his career, it looked like it was going to get him... you know, a shot in the arm. Instead, he started to take shots of whatever he was drinking. I guess in a celebratory way, or maybe he was frightened, he was a terrible alcoholic. All the indications are that he was a real drunk. And he killed himself before he got to go out there.
Charlie Poole's band was called The Ramblers, and you've got two rambling-themed songs on the album. And I think in a way, like the life of a professional musician is necessarily a rambling life. Do you like that part of what you do, or is it a burden to you?
Well, it's gotten to be a burden. You know, I mean, it was kind of fun in the beginning, but it's now just a bit of a. I think somebody said maybe my friend Tom Paxton says they pay us for getting here. It's fun to play and perform and exciting to write and sing, but it's a drag actually to be on the road, and it's a very killing kind of existence, you know, and it's not good for home life either. But it's what I do, and it's certainly what Charlie Poole did. I mean, those guys really rambled.
Is there anything that you like about it? I mean, above and beyond the, you know, getting to perform for 500 people every night.
You mean the traveling aspect of it?
Yeah.
I mean, on the other hand, I have to admit, I mean, I'm reading, as it turns out, a book about one of the great musicians and ramblers, Louis Armstrong. It's a great book called Pops. It's out this year. And, you know, there's a picture of him in a hotel room, and, you know, he's kind of in his underwear, and he's got a kerchief tied around his hat, and you can see his trumpet case, and, you know, the room is a mess, and you know, it looked great to me and very familiar. You know, there is a certain kind of familiarity when you check into your room, and of course, the problem is you have to transition back to your actual house and your family eventually, and that's kind of like reentering the atmosphere, or, you know, sometimes you can burn up.
It's interesting to me that you know, you had this life where you're constantly making that adjustment, and I can't imagine it's ever an easy one, and yet out of your if I'm not mistaken, out of your four children, three of them are professional musicians. Of course, Rufus Wainwright and Martha Wainwright, two very renowned singer-songwriters, are your children. Why do you think your kids ended up taking up the family business?
Well, again, you know, Rufus's mom is a wonderful musician and singer, and did a bit of rambling. That's Kate McGarrigle of Kate and Anna McGarrigle. And my other singing kid is Lucy Wainwright Roach, and her mom is Suzzy Roach of the Roaches, another musician. So I think, you know, when the moms and the dad are, you know, there is a kind of, it is the family business, and it makes perfect sense that they would drift into it. And they are doing it and doing well at it, and it's great. I mean, you know, there are the pitfalls, but it's wonderful to see and hear their work.
Do you think it's recommendable?
I mean, is it? Well, I didn't say, oh, don't do that. Be a lawyer or a marine biologist. It was exciting to watch them sing and play, and they're good at it. That's the other thing, is that, you know, all three of them are good. It would have been tougher, I think, if they weren't good. And then you would have had to say, oh, that's wonderful, dear. But, you know, it was quite clear that certainly Rufus was going places. At an early age, he was so raring to go that, you know, it was so obvious he wasn't going to go to law school. Lucy, on the other hand, you know, actually got a master's degree in teaching and was a teacher for a while. And every time there was a family event and party and the guitars would come out, she would kind of run and hide. But then, you know, it kicked in, and now she's traveling and writing and recording, and, you know, she's there. It's happening for her too. So, you know, it's they had to do it, I suppose.
Charlie Poole lived this life on the road, and, you know, his way of dealing with it was by burning very, very brightly, and drinking very, very heavily. And the title track on your tribute to him, High, Wide, and Handsome, is a song that you wrote that is sort of about that. Can you tell me a little bit about writing it, and even why you decided on a tribute record to combine the songs of the artist you were doing a tribute to and songs that were a tribute to Charlie Poole?
Well, I'll start at the tail end of that. I mean, the record was produced by my friend, and the whole idea for the record was his, a fellow here in New York called Dick Kennett. And he has a studio and has been a musician. He writes songs and arranges and produces, and he just thought it was a really interesting idea that we kind of try to inhabit this guy's world, certainly by recording the songs that he recorded. And then he and I wrote songs together and separately, nine all told. It's a double CD, so there's 30 tracks on it. But the idea was to just in terms of the writing, was to just try to somehow inhabit Poole's world, and it was fun, you know, because as we've discussed, you know, I'm of the habit to write about my own swinging life, so it was kind of fun for me to get off that thing and think about what it might be to be somebody like him.
It's interesting to me too that you know, this is a guy who, as we mentioned, didn't write these songs that he was performing. So in a way, you're almost like writing a song for him as a, you know, as a spirit or an idea or the tone or quality of him.
Yeah, I think you know, we in the writing that we did, Dick and I, you know, probably hoped that, you know, it might be something that Charlie would sing. I mean, we wrote a song about that trip up to New York to make that hit record, you know, way up in New York City. We imagined them on a train, taking that train ride. Dick wrote a wonderful song that he imagined Charlie Poole's wife would sing, a song called The Man in the Moon that Maggie Roach of the Roaches sings on the record. So, and this song, High, Wide, and Handsome, I wrote, you know, I grew up outside of New York in the suburbs of Westchester County, but my mother was from the deep, deep south, Tifton, Georgia, all the way down near the Florida border. And she came from that world that Charlie Poole was from, that rural country world. And she used the expression high, wide, and handsome. I don't know if it's a Southern expression, but she would use it, and it struck me that that expression, you know, would somehow might capture the kind of the drunkard's bravado, Poole was successful, but and he was brash, and he was self-destructive, and somehow I imagined that he would kind of revel in that, and that was the tone that I tried to get to in the song.
Why don't we hear it? Here's High, Wide, and Handsome from Loudon Wainwright III.
High, wide, and handsome, that's how I like living. High, wide, and handsome, that's how life should be. Low, skinny, and ugly, that's for other people. High, wide, and handsome suits me to a T. Song, wine, and women, they're my three favorites. Beer, gin, and whiskey, that's 5, 6, and 4. Saturday night I like eating and dancing. I sleep all day Sunday, so I'm ready for more. High, wide, and handsome, you can't take it with you. High, wide, and handsome, that's one way to go. Let's live it up. Might as well, we're all dying. High, wide, and handsome, let's put on a show. Can't quit what will kill me, so why even bother? I Love this hard living, so why even try? I'll be high, wide, and handsome when I kick the bucket. High, wide, and handsome on the day I die. High, wide, and handsome, you can call it my motto. High, wide, and handsome, you can call it my creed. Money's just paper, liquor's thicker than water. High, wide, and handsome in thought, word, and deed. Have high, wide, and handsome carved on my headstone with the date I was born, plus the date that I died. Then take one from the other, all that's left is a number. Just remember I laughed twice as hard as I cried. High, wide, and handsome, that's how I like living. High, wide, and handsome, that's how life should be. Low, skinny, and ugly, that's for other people. High, wide, and handsome suits me to a T.
Loudon Wainwright III performing High, Wide, and Handsome from his new record of the same name, a tribute to country music great Charlie Poole. One of my favorite songs on the record is another original of yours called Rowena. And it's a song that that actually came out of a sort of hybrid of thinking about this time, but also thinking about your own personal and family history. Tell me a little bit about how it came about.
Well, it's a song that I wrote, and then we changed a bit, and Dick did some writing on it. Dick Kinnett did some writing on it also. When my mother died in 1997, as you often do, I found myself, you know, you have to go through the filing cabinets and the drawers and, you know, settle things and look at things and read things. And I found some letters that her father wrote. I knew neither of my maternal grandparents. They died before I was born. My mother's mother died when my mother was seven. And my grandfather died when my mom was in her early 20s. But I found these amazing letters that the father, a guy called Walter Taylor, wrote to the woman that was going to become his wife, my grandmother, Rowena Long. They were courting letters. They were written around 1918. And I was just struck by them and by some of the wonderful language in them and the heartfelt nature of them. And I found myself writing this song about... From his point of view, as I say, I never saw her side. I never read her side of the story, but he was really trying to get her to write back to him. And apparently, she was not writing back to him, which was kind of freaking him out a little bit. But you want to hear this song?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Rowena, my darling, please don't let me down. A few words from you can lift me off the ground. Your letters are treasures, you don't know their worth. Days I don't receive when I fall back to earth. Rowena, my darling, just a word or two. It means the world to me, those few words from you. But when you don't send them, why can't you see? It's as if the whole world had gone back on me. Tonight when I'm sleeping, I will dream of you. wishfully thinking, what else can I do? Then in the morning, it's always the same. When dreaming is done, then I call out your name. Tonight when I'm sleeping, I will dream of you. Wishfully thinking, what else can I do? Then in the morning, I can only hope for my heart's deliverance in an envelope. Rowena, my dear, yours to hand this AM. I'm holding your letter in heaven again. A few words from me now to make sure you know. As ever, I love you for sure, don't you know?
Loudon Wainwright III performing Rowena from his most recent album called High, Wide, and Handsome. It's a tribute to the country great Charlie Poole. Well, gosh, Loudon, we're like pretty much out of time. Thank you so much for coming on The Sound of Young America. It was so great to have you on the show.
Well, I enjoyed being here, Jesse.
Loudon Wainwright's new album is High, Wide, and Handsome. He's also headed out on tour. He'll be in lots of places in February, March, April, and May, including Los Angeles, Santa Cruz, the Bay Area, and more. You can find out his full tour schedule and more about the album and his other work at LWIII, as in Loudon Wainwright III, .com. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our editor is Nick White in Chicago. Special thanks to WNYC in New York, who hosted Loudon Wainwright for our interview with him. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, and if you have thoughts about the show, you can email me at Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at MaximumFun.org. It's the Sound of Young America for MaximumFun.org and PRI. Public Radio International.